All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Conspiracy of Thought, and that was her piece, This Broken Heart, and it's from their CD, Nothing More Than Light. This is a really, really good, band, a really interesting CD with a lot of insightful stuff to say and worth a listen to. Some very cool and insightful things going on there. We've got a lot lined up for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Annie Day and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, two writers who recently reviewed the film Precious. And that's a very important, powerful, and beautiful film. Before that, we'll be talking with P.Z. Myers, the one and only P.Z. Myers. P.Z. is a professor of biology at the University of Minnesota and the author of the blog Pharyngula. This blog is known as the most popular science blog in the world, and P.Z. is a fearless advocate of science, truth, materialism, and fun. This is going to be the kickoff of what we want to develop as a monthly column with P.Z. And in the front end of the show, we're going to be talking with Joanne Mariner, a human rights lawyer, about the renewal of the Military Commissions Act under the Obama administration. Now, if you remember, this Military Commissions Act was first developed and passed by the Bush administration. That's right, and it was a paradigm-shifting law that set civil liberties back to somewhere, oh, I don't know, before the 10th century. Well, Obama not only renewed this law, but apparently the law that he pushed through very closely resembles the law that Bush first pushed through. But before we get into all this, I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about Obama's recent dramatic escalation of the war in Afghanistan. When all is said and done, 30,000 additional U.S. troops are going to be sent to Afghanistan, and they're going to be joined by thousands of additional NATO troops. These last couple of years, it seems like everyone has just sat back and said, seems like the wars are over. They aren't. And many people chose to believe that Obama, and despite his protest to the contrary, would quickly end the war in Afghanistan. He didn't, and he isn't. Now, I'm going to generously chalk up all this delusion to what I heard someone refer to a little while earlier as a whole lot of people smoking that Democrat and chugging the Obama-lade. But now, it's way past time to start looking at the world with clear eyes, with new eyes and clear eyes. If we remain silent in the face of these towering crimes against the people of the world, then we become complicit, and you know what? We even become monsters ourselves. I thought it might be important for all of us to listen to a few minutes of testimony about what it means for U.S. troops to make a war on and occupy Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, this testimony is from a cat named John Turner, and it was presented at the new Winter Soldier hearings held in 2008. This particular segment is taken from the 6-part web series, This Is Where We Take Our Stand. Now, this series is drawn from a new Winter Soldier hearings and was directed by David Zeiger, the director of Sir, No Sir, and Bester Cram and Mike Mahoros, the directors of Unfinished Symphony. And you can access this whole series at www.thisiswherewetakeourstand.com. Here's former Marine John Turner.
Happen if everything that's going on over in Iraq and Afghanistan, what if that happened on American soil?
Hey, sit down, you.
Hey. How would you feel if someone came into your house at 3 o'clock in the morning and terrorized your family?
Somebody get this old man.
How would you feel about that? I'm asking you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Michael Turner. I served with Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines as an automatic machine gunner. On April 18th, 2006, I had my first confirmed kill. This man was innocent. I don't know his name. I called him the Fat Man. He was walking back to his house, and I shot him in front of his friend and his father. The first round didn't kill him after I had hit him up here in his neck area, and afterwards he started screaming and looked right into my eyes. So I looked at my friend who I was on post with, and I said, well, I can't let that happen. So I took another shot and took him out. This is after one of the guys in a weapons company had gotten shot. This is a way that we would take out our aggression. There was no fire that was taken from that mosque. It was shot into because we were angry. I just want to say that I am sorry for the hate and destruction that I've inflicted on innocent people. And I'm sorry for the hate and destruction that others have inflicted on innocent people. At one point, it was okay. But reality has shown that is not, and that this is happening, and that until people hear about what is going on with this war, it will continue to happen and people will continue to die. I am sorry for the things that I did. I am no longer the monster that I once was. Thank you.
That was former Marine John Turner. He is no longer a monster. How about you? We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Joanne Mariner.
I see the opens on the streets of Afghanistan. I see the bones of the drones of Tajikistan. I see disease on their knees in Uzbekistan. I think we need a plan. Why do you silence the speech? I'm getting agitated.
That was yet another piece from Conspiracy of Thought called The Plan. Joanne Mariner is a lawyer working with Human Rights Watch, and she recently wrote a piece about the Obama administration's renewal of the infamous Military Commissions Act. Joanne looked at the changes in the act and concluded that really not that much of substance had changed at all from the days of the Bush administration. Her piece, titled A First Look at the Military Commissions Act, can be found in the November 17th issue of Counterpunch online. Joanne, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Hi. In late October, Obama signed the 2010 National Defense Authorization Act, which included a package of changes to the rules governing military commission proceedings, and it's called the Military Commissions Act of 2009. So, Joanne, what's going on here? What is the new version of the Military Commissions Act, and what's your take on it?
Yeah, it's revisions to the Military Commissions Act of 2006, which was the legislation that President Bush got through Congress in the wake of the Supreme Court decision in the Hamdan case that struck down the military commission. So it's an effort to revive the commission. Obama announced in May that he was going to revive the commissions to try some people held at Guantanamo. So it's basically an effort by the Obama administration to not look like they are reviving the Bush system of commissions, but that they're creating a reformed, improved, fairer system of commissions.
Well, how are they doing, Julie?
And yeah, judged by that goal, I mean, from our perspective, there's no need to create a separate system of commissions in the first place when you have federal courts that are perfectly capable of handling these cases. But even accepting the need for commissions, we don't believe that the reforms that were included in this act go far enough. Specifically, the jurisdictional provisions are way overbroad. They cover children, so just as with the Bush administration, you have people who allegedly committed crimes while they were juveniles being prosecuted before these commissions. You have people who allegedly committed crimes that have nothing to do with armed conflict being prosecuted before these commissions. So what are normally considered terrorist acts are being tried before these commissions. You have still very loose rules on hearsay that are inconsistent with U.S. constitutional standards. You have coerced evidence. The rules were tightened. It's not nearly as bad as the Bush administration system, but you still have the possibility of coerced evidence being allowed before the court, which is extremely problematic.
Let me ask you this. In your piece, you describe a number of the changes that have occurred, but a lot of these changes that have been brought down are also very cosmetic. There's some that are real and have an effect on how they're doing. And I think that's part of why Obama is in there in terms of rebranding the empire and what they're doing. But there's also, there's some things that are just very cosmetic. And one of the things I found very interesting is you speak a lot to changing the category unlawful enemy combatant to unprivileged enemy belligerent. Now, that is greasy, okay? That just seems to me is really
that's
greasy.
That's simply a rhetorical change. And it's an effort to get away from the vocabulary that I think was somewhat stigmatized during the Bush administration of this idea of enemy combatant. So one of the first things the Obama administration did in its litigation about Guantanamo was saying, okay, we're not calling these people enemy combatants anymore. We're calling them unprivileged enemy belligerents, and we're using the same definition. So that really truly is a cosmetic change, and it has no substantive impact.
Now, you talk about also that in sort of these three grounds for being eligible for a military commission's hearings, you know, we talk about this thing of membership in Al-Qaeda, whether or not you've engaged in or supported hostilities against the U.S. Now, how different is that than under the Bush regime?
The idea that people who support hostilities can be tried before these commissions is exactly the same as it was in the Bush-era Military Commissions Act, the law that was passed in 2006. And what's interesting is since that law was passed, you've had a lot of federal court decisions in the Guantanamo litigation assessing whether someone who simply provides support to hostilities, and just to give an example, that would be someone who, for example, is a driver of driving in supplies or someone who's in no way a combat role but some kind of support role, whether they can be considered combatants. And there's some variation in the court decisions, but the clear trend is to ruling the people who support hostilities cannot be considered combatants. It's not the same thing as engaging in hostilities. So it's interesting that the Obama administration's really ignored those rulings and taken the same position as the Bush administration in saying that people who support hostilities can be considered the same as people who actually engaged in hostilities.
I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking right now with human rights attorney Joanne Mariner about the renewal of the Military Commissions Act by the Obama administration. One point that you bring out is the Taliban seems to occupy a very special position in all of this. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Well, in the previous Military Commissions Act, people who were members of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or associated groups could be tried before the commissions. And it specified membership in Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. It specified those two groups. This law specifies Al-Qaeda. It continues to specify Al-Qaeda, but it's dropped the Taliban. And I think that just may be indicative of more flexibility from this administration in relation to the Taliban and perhaps looking at what's going on in Afghanistan and considering the Taliban as a potential party for negotiations and not simply sort of permanently branded in legislation as the enemy.
Which is, to my mind, is really revealing in the sense of they keep constantly telling us that they're trying to bring to Afghanistan, and here they're opening up to a regime that has meant horror for most of the people who lived under it. It's just an incredible, very, very revealing and disgusting development. You have a point here where you talk about Obama's law is overbroad on the war on terror. And in particular, I was fascinated with this thing of terrorist acts outside of any war zone. How is this difference? That the terrorist acts outside of any war zone, and then this idea that this isn't just something that came up off of 9/11. This is actually something that people can be prosecuted for things that they want to go for that happened in 1996, for instance. It seems to be a very broad definition. How different is that from what Bush did?
Well, to some extent, it depends on how it's going to be implemented. And we've seen, I think, a really encouraging sign recently when the Obama administration announced that it was transferring the September 11th case to U.S. federal court. So it was treating that case as a horrible crime and not treating those alleged perpetrators as soldiers in a conflict. But under this legislation, it's certainly possible for people implicated in terrorist acts, implicated in serious crimes, to be treated as soldiers, to be treated as combatants. And in fact, under the legislation, it can be criminal acts that occurred before September 11th. So some people who, to some extent, buy the idea of a war on terrorism think that, well, that war started with the September 11th attacks. But under this legislation, and we saw in practice during the Bush administration, people who were implicated in terrorist crimes dating as far back as 1996 were being prosecuted before the military commission. So they were being treated as soldiers. And that is one of, I think, the most sort of expansive and paradigm shifting aspects of the Bush administration's approach to fighting terrorism was this idea that it's a war, that we take alleged combatants in that war and we hold them on Guantanamo. So if you buy into that picture, you really buy into the whole package of Guantanamo, of military commissions, of a completely different approach to dealing with what we used to consider horrendous, serious crimes.
And the fact that Obama would, I mean, all these things that you're talking about that are very similar to Bush, and the fact that he also developed, continues to maintain that there is a need for military commissions and all this other stuff. To me, that paradigm shift, and I do remember when the Military Commissions Act passed, civil liberties lawyers all over the world were very, very, very concerned about what was concentrated in that law. And to continue this, I think, should make everyone who's sentient to have some major concern about what the hell is going on here.
Truly, because yeah. I think the underlying point of this shifted approach is to cut back on basic rights, cut back on basic fairness, to have a system that's rigged. And I think this system is much less rigged than, you know, the Bush administration's first attempt at military commissions. It's much less rigged than the system that was passed in 2006. But it's still nothing compared to the standards that we rely on in our U.S. federal courts.
It's kind of like putting a velvet wrap around the hangman's noose there to me. You know, it won't burn your neck, but you're going to be dead. Tell me one thing here, Joanne. I thought there was one very interesting point in the final part of your article that is just very compelling, and that is you talk about there's one place in which the new law scope is not too broad, but rather too limited, in that it only covers aliens.
Right, it singles out aliens, and I think that's indicative. If the law had covered citizens, I think you would have seen much more serious public debate about the law and about the provisions of the law, because people would say, that could be potentially applied to me, that could be applied to my neighbors, that could be applied to, you know, my co-citizens. But the fact that it only covers aliens, people think of the detainees held at Guantanamo that had been dehumanized over the years. I think that led to much less public debate and much less scrutiny of the law's flaws.
Mm-hmm. And I thought actually one thing that you made, and I think we'll end on this, I just can't help just reading from your article, and you don't have to comment. I just think it's a very, very important point, and that is you say, if the truth is that these commissions are too unfair to be used on U.S. citizens, they're really too unfair to be used on anyone. And that's something, I think, an orientation that people really need to get a hold of. We need to stop thinking like Americans and start thinking about humanity. This is the situation that we're all faced with today. Joanne, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show. We've been talking today with Joanne Mariner from Human Rights Watch. She has a piece in Counterpunch, I think it was last week or a couple weeks ago, and you can search her name on Counterpunch and come to the article. And it's all about a first look at the Military Commissions Act, the new Military Commissions Act passed under the Obama regime. We're going to take a short break and be right back with P.Z. Myers. Welcome back. That was This Side of Heaven from International Noise Conspiracy. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're going to move right into our next section of the show. Somebody who's hopefully that we're going to be able to make this into a regular column, a monthly column. And I talked about this a few months ago and really dragged my feet on getting it started. And we just reconnected recently. And I want to welcome to the show P.Z. Myers. P.Z. is a biologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and he's the author of the science blog Pharyngula, which is not only mine, but many other people's. In fact, all over the world, people everywhere flock to this blog, and it's a very, very compelling, and it's a place where hypocrites and bores oftentimes get the pin stuck in their eye. And P.Z., welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to be here.
As I told you yesterday, I want to start out with you letting people get a chance to hear your Thanksgiving Day thoughts.
Aha, you want me to just read this cranky little complaint I brought up yesterday?
Absolutely. You wouldn't be a curmudgeon if you didn't.
Right. Okay, here goes. So, sorry, I don't believe in Thanksgiving Day. This whole notion that we should have vague and aimless feelings of gratitude for the nature of one's existence is just too weird. And the bow your head at the table and radiate blessings at the cosmos tradition is pointless and silly. Don't get me wrong, I can be appropriately and happily grateful to people who've gone out of their way to do good for me. Mom will get a phone call and my wife will get a hug, and they really are appreciated. But for the most part, our existence is not the product of selfless altruism, and there's nothing out there that can be aware of just how glad you are to be alive, no matter how fawning and fulsome you may be. The universe is cold and uncaring. You may be grateful that you weren't vaporized by a meteor falling out of the sky this year, but there's no agent out there who will feel pleased that you noticed. And the fact of your general relief that your existence continues will not be a factor in the motion of space rocks in the next year. I'm happy that the microbes didn't turn me into a pile of putrefying goo yet. But it wasn't an act of thoughtful kindness on their part, since the little bastards are doing their best to get past my defenses all the time, and all that's keeping them at bay is my constant expenditure of energy to keep my immune system at readiness. And they'll also get me one day, for sure, unless that meteor vaporizes me into a cloud of inorganic molecules with minimal nutritional value first. We're all doomed. We're currently survivors by luck, sustained by selfish processes, and I don't thank luck because she, if she were an autonomous, self-aware agent, and she isn't, will turn for me or against me without concern for my feelings. Nature is not appeasable. Get over it. That poor bird that most of you will have on your dining room table is a perfect metaphor. It went through its life dumb and mostly content, getting its feed shoveled in front of its face every day, and then last week, the machinery's of profit began to move, and it found itself trussed on an assembly line. Then a gang of people who were mostly concerned with trudging through another day and making a living wage decapitated it, gouged out its guts, stripped off its feathers, and wrapped it in plastic so you could thoughtlessly stuff fragments of its carcass into your hungry maw. The universe did not rotate about that bird, and neither does it spin about you. If you're eating tofurkey, you aren't off the hook either. Think of the soybeans. So don't sit at your table and think you're being good by warmly thanking an indifferent universe or for whatever. It doesn't care. Don't beam happy thoughts at the farmers who stocked your larder. They can't hear you, and they did it for their own personal profit anyway. Above all, don't be hypocritical and radiate gratitude at the corpse of the turkey, since it's dead and during its brief life would rather you hadn't fueled the market forces that led to its execution. You'll be far wiser to sit at that table and contemplate the threats to your existence and scheme about how you're going to get them first. Oh, and you probably do have people who have done good things for you, at personal cost, and without carrying out the calculus of profit. If you want to have a day of thankfulness, thank them personally. None of this nonsense of bland, undirected, unfocused, smug gratitude. Share human feelings with other human beings. Also, gods don't exist, so they haven't done squat for you. Don't waste your time praying to them either.
The one and only P.Z. Myers. Thank you, man. You know, and I got to tell you, it's a constant fight in my life to not sit around and think about all the things that are threats to my existence and scheme about getting at them first.
Right.
I constantly have to fight that.
Yeah, most of it's carried out automatically. Your body takes care of it physiologically, but you still have to do things like feed yourself to keep it going.
Right, right, exactly. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about going through your blog, and I really encourage people to go to Pharyngula, and that's, I'm trying to think of how to spell it without sounding like an idiot, getting it wrong, Pharyngula.
Very good.
There you go. All right. See, I got spelling bees. Catholic school, okay? That's what did it. It's a tremendous blog. Once a month, we'll try and get there and cover some of the things that you think are important to talk about, things that I might be really fixated on as I read it. But I wanted to talk this time in particular around this piece you have in there about called Researchers' Nightmares. And in particular, because there's a lot of this voodoo science and voodoo medicine that seems to always talk about things that they pull from research and scientific experiment and scientific backing and all this stuff. And you make a point here about how so much of what researchers do is then taken and twisted to serve nefarious purposes. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, because what the scientists are doing is they're going out and they're trying to go step by step through a problem and work it out. And these other people are parasitizing them. They're coming in when there's some preliminary result and misusing it. So this particular article is about autism, and you know, autism is pretty hot right now. Lots of people are worried about it. Lots of people have fixed blame inappropriately on things like vaccines. And researchers have been working their way through it and figuring out little pieces of the puzzle. So, for instance, it starts off with this work of Carlos Pardo, who has discovered that the autistic brain is exhibiting more signs of inflammation than the non-autistic brain. So what does that mean? I mean, the scientists are interested. They want to figure out what's going on. But what immediately happens is a bunch of quacks jump on this and say, well, we've got a therapy for that. They don't even know what the problem is, but they've got a therapy. One way to think of it is, you know, imagine you take your car in to the mechanic, and the mechanic makes a preliminary examination and says, oh, you've got a problem with your transmission. And that's all he says. You've got a problem with your transmission. We got to do some more diagnostics to figure it out. But immediately a bunch of people jump on the bandwagon and say, well, we can fix that. And they say things like they'll take a hammer to it and pound the heck out of it and that'll fix it. Or they'll load it up with mysterious solvents. They'll do all these mysterious things that they don't have a basis for. And that's what's going on with this autism research. preliminary results are being hijacked to provide justifications for quack medicines.
It's a very important thing because these are not like snake oil salesmen who are just going out and just doing harmless things in the universe. It is interesting. They lay all kinds of claims to their own medical expertise, their own educational standards. They try to build their credibility. And these things can actually do harm. And I was thinking about this article that you cite on your blog and from the Chicago Tribune. It talks about the ways that some of these things that have been developed as alternative treatments for autism actually can do quite a bit of harm to people.
Oh, yeah. So, for instance, they cite Carlos Pardo's work. He's talking about inflammation, so there's all these reactions going on in the brain. And you've got people who are saying, well, we're going to inject these children with these powerful immunosuppressants, you know, the kinds of things that they use for transplant therapies, and basically shut down their immune system, which sounds pretty dangerous right there. And at the same time, there's another group that are saying, well, we're going to inject them with immunoglobulins. We're going to amp up the immune response. So we've got two completely opposite reactions that they're promoting, and they have no basis for saying which way they ought to go.
There was another one that was spoken to in that article about basically blasting oxygen, pure oxygen into people, and the kinds of consequences of that. Or the other one, the fatty acid chain, that's the one that always got me, because that's so popular these days. They can grab hold of a scientific phrase and say, fatty acid chain, or something else like that, and then act like this sort of justifies everything they're doing.
All right. Metabolism is another favorite word. You know, any of these magical processes that are going on in the human body, they'll act as if they know exactly what's going on and say, well, we'll go fix that. And they can't. They can't just... All these things are tied together in complicated ways, and responses are difficult. And it takes serious scientists years and years of work to puzzle out exactly what's going on. These shortcuts don't help.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with biology professor and blogger extraordinaire, P.Z. Myers. Well, what would you say to people, P.Z., people especially in the world today, the swine flu, the this, that, every time you turn around, there's something. You're either being poisoned by the environment, you're living on top of a gasoline dump, your kids are going to school drinking water that is totally carcinogenic. There's all these things that are happening, and people are looking for ways. And there is some value to alternative medicine in a certain sense. Yeah. I mean, can you talk about that a little bit, the difference between recognizing the value of alternative medicine and what these things are?
Well, we have to qualify our terms a little bit. There really is no such thing as alternative medicine. There's just good medicine. And so what you will often hear touted as the virtues of alternative medicine is actually the virtues of regular medicine as well. And that's things like moderation and having a good diet and exercising regularly and maintaining yourself and taking care of yourself. You will not find any regular official sorts of doctors who are denying that. They'll say, yeah, that's all good stuff. You should do that. And that's what they're always telling me. I'll get more exercise, eat better, that kind of stuff. That is not the domain of alternative medicine, although they like to pretend that it is. So, yeah, you know, I would say that if you've got somebody who's worried about something, that's the first place they should start, is preventative medicine, is take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. I would also say that if you're living on a toxic waste dump, the preventive medicine should have started much earlier, and it should have been in awareness of social causes, and you should have been fighting to keep people from dumping toxic waste in your backyard.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. A very important point and a recognition of where that comes and what people can do about it. We're going to give you more time next month, but I want to move into this next thing, which is you have a contest you've announced, and I wanted you to announce to people so they can come in. Can you tell people what it is, how it developed, what it is, and how they can enter it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So a creationist wrote into me, and he claimed that Hitler built his ideas on evolution and Darwin. So Darwin was Hitler's predecessor, and he claimed that there's no way that complexity can evolve, that natural processes cannot build complexity, they can only tear it down. And I have dealt with these arguments 1,000 times, over and over again. So what I did instead this time is I posted those questions on my website. It's under a post called I Get Me Email and a Contest. And what I did is I posted those questions. I said, okay, anybody, leave a comment here. In 500 words or less, answer one of these questions. And in December, mid-December, I will go through and pick the best answers. I'll post them again. And the winner will get a free book from my collection of weird books piled up in my office.
Okay, you know, I just may enter that contest. Is it really, I mean, does this really come up a lot, this idea that evolution influenced Hitler?
All the time. It's constant. There's been a number of books that have come out about it. I recently even debated a guy who argued this. There's this naive notion that Hitler was a godless atheist who used science to make his decisions about what to do with people, which is actually completely wrong. He was a good Catholic. Well, I should qualify. He wasn't such a good Catholic to modern Catholics. He endorsed Catholicism, but he did a lot of things that obviously were not in Catholic dogma. But also, his ideas were not based on science. They were based on sort of vaguely understood eugenic principles. They take more from farming and how to handle domesticated animals than they do from science. He also disliked Darwin. His most important mentor was a guy named Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who was a crazy racist philosopher at the turn of the last century, who actively despised Darwin and said that this was completely wrong.
Well, what do people say when they raise this argument that Hitler was influenced by Darwin? I mean, what do they argue?
Oh, well, that's another weird thing. What are you going to argue? I mean, you know, even if it were true, it wouldn't change the facts of the science. So it's kind of a personal ad hominem attack on the whole idea. But in general, what I think is they're not thinking. That what they're doing is saying, well, I know somebody who's really evil, and that's Hitler, and I don't like evolution, so that must be really evil, so they have to be tied together somehow, and then inventing a connection.
It's interesting, the point you just made I think is really important, the idea that even if it was true that Hitler was influenced by evolution and Darwin, even if that was true, that wouldn't negate the truth of evolution, you know, the fact
exactly.
of evolution. And that's a very important thing for people to grapple with, because we can't deal with political truth or the idea that who you are determines the usefulness of or the truthfulness of science. Science is science, and it's true or it's false, you know, and that's a very important point, I think, for people's orientation in the world today.
And I would agree with him that evolution does have unpleasant consequences. It means we arrived here by a long chain of historical evils, that there's been culling of the population by nature, and that's what led to us. But to argue against it is like arguing against gravity, because, you know, if you jump out of a 10th-floor window, you will die because of gravity. That doesn't mean that gravity is wrong.
Wait a minute, I got to take a note on that, okay? Change afternoon plans, okay?
Right. Yes. What that means is that you oppose the force of gravity throughout your life. And similarly, we try to oppose the force of evolution. Evolution is all these organisms in nature trying to kill you all the time. And we fight that. That doesn't mean that we say, oh, well, bacteria need to live, so I'm going to curl up and die and let them feast. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. PZ Myers. PZ, we're going to have to get you a theme song for this monthly column, man. So send one to me. I want to hear what you think. And I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we'll have you back in just about a month. And so people can go to Pharyngula and they can see where the contest, and they can send their entries to you and hope to get one of your weird books. And if I send one and I win, I want one of the weirdest ones you have, okay?
Those could be really weird.
Okay, well, we'll go with it. All right, PZ Myers, thank you very much, brother.
Okay.
All right, talk to you again.
Bye.
I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. That was PZ Myers, biologist, professor at the University of Minnesota, and the author of the Pharyngula blog, which you should really visit. It's an extremely important and extremely interesting blog. We're going to take a short break and come right back to talk with Annie Day and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan about the film Precious. Woman of the Ghetto from Marlena Shaw and her album The Spice of Life. Marlena Shaw's work is just incredible, and that song in particular is something everyone should, again, listen to. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. I recently watched a movie that was one of the most powerful films I've seen in a long time. I'm talking about Precious, And rather than go on at length myself about the film, I thought it'd be good if we just took a listen to the trailer for the film so you have some idea of what I'm talking about. And then we'll come back and talk to the writers Aaron Aubrey Kaplan and Annie Day about Precious.
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine. I wish I had a light-skinned boyfriend with real nice hair. But first, I want to be in one of them BET videos.
You're a dummy. Don't nobody want you. Don't nobody need you. School ain't gonna help none. Take your ass down to the welfare.
You're 16, you're still in junior high school, and you're pregnant with your second child. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about home? But you're gonna have to talk to somebody if you want your check, sweetie. People tell me my
life is Precious, I'm hungry. You plan on putting some food in that frying pan?
My favorite color is purple. I sing well, and I'm here because I love to teach.
I'm Noanne. My favorite color is fluorescent beige, and I'm here to get my GED.
Harry's, something you do well?
Nothing.
Everybody's good at something.
Precious, you gonna stand up there and look down at me like you're a woman? You don't know what real women do. Real women sacrifice. Now smile about that, too fat bitch.
Talk about the abuse in your household. You know what I'm talking about.
You sit there and judge me, and you write them notes on your pad about who you think I am. Nobody loves me.
People do love you, Precious.
Please don't love me. Love ain't done nothing for me. Beat me. Make me so worthless.
Your baby loves you.
That's a little taste of the film Precious, starring Gabori Gabby Sidibe as Precious, Monique as her mother Mary, Mariah Carey, Lenny Kravitz, Sherry Shepherd, and Paula Patton. We're going to join now two writers, Annie Day, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, journalist and contributing editor to the op-ed section of the Los Angeles Times. And they're coming to us today to talk about the film Precious. Each of them has written a recent review of the film. And the film itself, if you don't know, is based on the novel Push by Sapphire. And it traces, through a transformation, it traces the life of 16-year-old Clarice Precious Jones. And the character of this film are people that rarely fill the movie screen. They're people, which we'll talk about later, that you never, hardly ever see, at least not see in the kind of light you see them in Precious. Aaron, Annie, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here, Michael. Thanks.
Yeah. And Annie, you still there?
Yeah.
Aaron, yes. Now you're getting lower. Okay.
Oh,
well,
I am.
Now we're fine. I think, I don't know, it seems the two channels are going in and out, but
important to be heard, Michael.
No, it's just important for me to be heard, Aaron.
I hear you.
I
hear you, yes.
All right. Well, let's open this up on each of you. I'll ask each of you, and maybe Aaron, you first, and the overall take on the film. What's your overall take on Precious?
Well, I think it's very powerful. It presented something I had not seen on the screen before, which is a very sort of individual interior story about a girl who happens to live in a black ghetto. All the social conditions are there, but you really end up being involved in her story. That seems like a simple concept, but it is rarely done in black film. I'm sure it's been done before, but it's so rare that when you see it, you don't quite know what you're seeing. And I actually went in prepared to hate it. I said this in my piece for Salon.com. I saw the previews, and I thought, oh, gosh, I have to dust off my picket signs. This looks very bad. But it's just not that at all. And I realized watching the film that I had to contend with my own sort of tendency to define black folk by how we are seen by other people. It's very complicated, and I'm sure you understand that, Michael. But that was one of many things I had to confront in watching the film. But basically, to be involved in the story of this girl who, as a character, we never, ever see on screen, as you say, was pretty remarkable. And I thought it was more remarkable because there were a couple of high-profile folks in the film, Lenny Kravitz and Mariah Carey, and they really were not the center of the film at all. They were just accoutrements, and for all the talk they got, it really was about this girl. And I think, I'll just say one thing, I think what really pushed people's buttons is just the physical presence of this girl. She's black, but she's very dark-skinned, very large, very kind of shut down emotionally, exactly the kind of girl all of us pass by, all of us ignore in one way or another. So I think in that, you know, it was a very sort of radical film to me.
Annie, your take?
Yeah, I think what Aaron is saying is important, this, that all of us pass by the Preciouses and what that means, and then what it means to see her on screen in a way that defies the caricature. And our society, I think, works really hard to suppress and to caricature sort of the quote fat black girls and quote unquote welfare mothers. And then what does it mean that these people are portrayed as they actually are, as fully human? So I think that's a real contribution. And then it's also a really beautifully rendered film. And the performances, I thought, you know, I agree, were stunning. You know, and then I think what it's doing in terms of society and breaking open this discussion really matters. I saw it with a couple people, but a black woman I saw it with afterwards was bowled over because her life is never shown on film, and what difference that makes.
I saw it with a few people too, and everyone was just exactly, I mean, it was people just kept saying it's, and it was a very multinational crew I went with, and everyone was just stunned, and they were talking about this is probably the most emotionally and physically exhausting film they've ever seen, you know, and because of what was concentrated in that. And this point about the people you never see in movies or you only see as stereotypes. There's a point where Precious is speaking, when the first time she ever speaks up in class, and it's in that pre-GED class she's taking, and I'm going to try not to give away a whole lot of things about the plot, you know, where she makes the point when she speaks and she's asked, how does that make you feel? And she says, I feel here. And you get a sense that this is what this film is doing. Annie is, and Aaron, as both of you pointed to, this is not stereotyping. The people that you never see in these movies, and not, and unless you see them as a stereotype, as something to be laughed at or shunned or abhorred, these are, in all their humanity, they're here. There's a certain universal resonance, I think, to that. Aaron, you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Michael, but you know what's so interesting and so sad, because we have such a screwed up racial history in this country, is I've discussed this film with other people I know, including a very good friend of mine who is a screenwriter, very smart guy. He's white, as it happens, but he hated this film because he looked at it and saw those stereotypes. And he's not alone. There are many people, including a lot of black people, who reacted very sort of viscerally to just the presentation, because when you look at just the physical image, not just of Precious, but of her surroundings, you see Jerry Springer, you see the stereotypes that we automatically say, that we automatically fight against. I understand that position, but it's left us in a state where we really, you know, we have to be able to sort of drill down through the stereotypes to get to a story. And I think that, as I say in another piece I've written for The Times, which is coming out Sunday, for black folk, and really for everybody else, art and politics are totally inseparable. And that's kind of unfortunate. I understand it. But I think many people are not able to get past this, you know, simply the image of what's up there. It's ugly, true. But the question really is, can we make a film about black poor people without it being a joke? Mm-hmm. Because that's what we tend to do. So there's a lot we have to wrestle with here. And I have to say one thing. My good friend who I was arguing about this, you know, I was arguing with this film, he refused to see it as anything but a collection of stereotypes. But he ended up saying, later, he said, you know, I saw this film at the Landmark, and mostly white crowd, and he was appalled at how people laughed. They laughed when Precious's mother threw the TV down the stairs. They laughed at the abuse. They laughed at several things, and I think that shaped his reaction. He was furious. I think he was furious with the white folk, but also angry with the film for provoking that reaction. So you end up judging the film for the reactions it provokes rather than for the story it tells. I'm not saying you have to like the film, but it's very difficult to isolate just the artistic merit and the personal merit because it is so loaded with politics.
Well, Aaron, I'm saying you do have to like the film because I loved it. I tell you,
I
thought it was really one of the most important films I've seen in a long time. Annie, any comments on what Aaron just said?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I do think, just to go back to the first point, one of the things Precious says in the film is she's just taken this test and wherein which she can only write her name. And afterwards, she's walking down the street and she says, these tests paint me and my mom as ugly black grease to be wiped away. And I really think that is how society, you know, and you said it, Michael, that you only ever see these people on the butt of a cruel joke. So I think that's one, and it is politics there, that you're actually defying that and you're showing a very, very deep story and with all the humanity and heart. But I also think, look, on the one hand, I understand why, and I appreciated, Aaron, you walked through your first reaction was, and then after having seen the film, film. Mm-hmm. And I understand why people in the black community were frightened about what this movie, or angry or concerned about what this movie was going to be. Because everywhere you turn in a thousand different ways, you have black people who are portrayed as minstrelsy in mass culture and music. And this is what gets portrayed in very demeaning and degrading ways. But I actually think this film defies that. It's going up against that and doing something very different. And I do think people have to see it. And then I think in particular, when you have the question of women's oppression, when you have the what happens in the family getting exposed in this way, I think that's part of what goes into the knee-jerk response. And this is where a lot of the analogy to the discussion about The Color Purple has come in. And is it airing dirty laundry when black women and women overall finally get a chance to speak out and have their stories told, or is it really needed?
Mm-hmm. I know I heard an audible gasp in the theater when I went. When Precious goes into this whole point and she says, "No one ever loved me," and you're looking at this and you're thinking, and it just hits you in the head. It's like, mm-hmm. this woman, she's so beautiful, and yet in this society, she's lived a life where no one cared about her, and you're brought into this position of having to care for her very deeply. To me, that was really just a critical moment in the film.
Yeah, I agree, but it's also quite a challenge to people. When she says no one loves me, she's indicting the audience, frankly. And I saw it with a mostly black audience, and they were really into it, but in the beginning, you know, they were sort of kind of being audible and even laughing here and there, and then they just kind of stopped. By the time we got to that moment where she says that, people didn't know what to say, because in a way we've all been guilty of that. I don't know about Anita, but I grew up seeing these girls, seeing them taunted and teased. And I grew up in the 70s, where in the middle, sort of the height of the black power thing, but the worst thing you could call somebody was black. And the blacker you were, the worse you were. And if you were female and overweight, it was just really painful just to observe. I think that it resonated for the audience. Not only just resonated, they felt sort of captured, sort of not accused, that's too strong a word, but a light was shone on them. And they didn't know quite how to react. I think that's what a good movie does. But it was a very interesting reaction. I hadn't quite seen that in a black audience. They didn't quite know what to do with the story. They liked it. They applauded at the end, but didn't quite know how to react with the information.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with writers Aaron Aubrey Kaplan and Annie Day about the film Precious. There's one character, Monique's character in the film, is just, she did such an incredible job. And as I understand, in the face of people actually warning her that this could mean the end of her career, have very harmful effects on her career. Throughout the film, you really hate this person. And then there's a point where something bigger happens, and it's enlightening. And I think it leads into where I want to take the discussion from here, is you get a sense, which I think is, again, this film is not easy on any level. It doesn't go for the easy story or the easy answers, because you hate Mary and then something bigger happens and you begin to see, where did somebody like Mary come from? Annie, can you speak to that? You make a good point in your review around that, I think.
Yeah, I think this is one of the pivotal elements of the film. Is Mary, the monologue, the character played by Monique, has a monologue and talks about how she got to the place she is. And she's in the social worker's office with Precious. And at a certain point she says, you know, "You're right, I want Precious and I want her grandson because they belong to me." And in that scene and in that sentence, you get a sense of what it means to have to be locked within the confines of the family in particular. Think about that. They belong to me. And what happens in the family where, you know, Mary, her only, the way she sees it, all of her self-worth is bound up being the property of a man, of her husband, of Carl, and then exchanging and sacrificing her daughter for the love of that man. And this is not, you know, I make a point in the piece that this is not an anomaly, but a distillation. And even in situations and circumstances where it's not as extreme, the brutality, the abuse, the sexual violence is not as extreme, this is a situation that still, in essence, gets recreated by the millions, where women and children are the property of men. And this has to do with the historic roots of the family and its present-day reality. But I think the other thing, and related to that, about the response to the film, has been just the outpourings of testimony of women online, in the theater lobbies, of just, they're just speaking bitterness about what's happened in their lives. And I quote a bunch of these forums, and you get a sense that there's been no outlet for this, for the suffering en masse that women face, mostly within the family. And, you know, I quote, "I was a child touched by my stepfather. My daughter was raped. My father abused me, my uncle this." And this is the life and the reality for millions of women in this society. And you get a sense then how people become monstrous in that situation.
Let me interject here. And this is a critical question I wanted to ask both of you, because you both speak to it in a way in your reviews. Both of you. Aaron, you describe Precious as the bogeywoman of both white society and black society, and especially the black middle class. And I kept thinking about all the work you've done around Cosby and this question of personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. And Annie, you do the same thing. You say some people see this as a testimony to making the right choices and how that will help set you free. Can each of you, in about 2 minutes each, speak to that?
I think that one of the most interesting things about the film is not the white reaction, it's the black reaction and this class tension. As you pointed out, you know, the black poor have been a real issue last 5 years or so, and the arguments around what the black poor need to be doing, et cetera, is really intense. And it's interesting, I don't see Precious as political that way. It doesn't tell you the best way, what we should do, which way we should go. It's just kind of presenting things as they are, and it actually does both. It indicts a system that keeps folks trapped in this, really, what amounts to modern-day slavery, but it also, of course, tells a very single individual story of someone who manages to not escape the system, but to do better within it. And so, again, that's part of its ambiguity, but its complexity. And so I think that's why there's a relative quiet amongst black people about, you know, there's not a real verdict about the film because it really covers a lot of bases, and you can't say that it supports this political thing or this other thing. And that's what makes it so interesting. And it's funny, I've not heard from Mr. Cosby himself on this movie, and that's, in fact, not just Cosby, but many other people, and I think that speaks to the effect, the power of the film.
Very, very interesting point. Annie?
Yeah, I think what Aaron is saying is important, and I do think what I found interesting was coming to it, what people took from it in interviews Revolution Newspaper did with people after the film, that people would say, you know, this shows if you can make good choices, even if that wasn't the verdict in the film. And I would argue just the opposite, and I do this thing in my piece where I talk about, look, fast forward 10 years, what happens to the social workers? What happens to the teachers and the girls like Precious? They are for their welfare gets cut. You know, no matter how good a mother Precious is, she's raising a black child in America, which means he has a target on his back. You know, regardless of the choices she makes, you know, and yes, you want her to triumph, and her, you know, there's the inspiration, there is her potential. But as long as this system stands and as she exists within the confines of this system, she's locked. And I think the real choice is whether we're going to confront these social larger relations in society, or whether we're going to come together in resistance and make a revolution and build a different system and a different, where it's not, in the way Aaron said, living off keeping people in virtual slavery, but actually where the preciouses of the world can be the glimmer of a whole different world. And I'll just end here that one of the resonance of Precious girls isn't in the horrors they face, but in the potential and that can be where they're cherished and loved as such.
Perfect spot to end on. Aaron, Annie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay. And Aaron's review is at Salon.com, and you'll have one appearing in the L.A. Times.
Yes, this is actually an essay that kind of goes into this discussion of black reaction to the film.
Okay, great. And Annie's review is in Revolution Newspaper. You can pick up on newsstands everywhere now, and you can also find it at www.revcom.us. Annie, thank you very much. Aaron, thank you. Talk to you soon.
Okay, great. Okay. See ya.
Bye now. I'm Michael Slate, and you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm the host and producer of the show. I want to thank my engineer today, Melissa Figueroa, Age, for his help in fine-tuning the show, my production assistant, Henry, and I want to thank all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you know, tell me your opinions, your thoughts, your ideas for shows, and so on, please do so at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And remember, the thing that's behind this show is that there is a better way of life than under this system. There's a whole other way that we could be and that we should be living, and it's up to us to get there. So with that in mind, make sure you get out, see Precious, and check PZ's blog out and everything else, and I'll talk to you again next week. We're going to go out with a piece from Boots Riley and the Coup, one of my favorite songs from him. It's called Heaven Tonight.
Late. my lungs. Made my arteries and heart oscillate as one. If police come, may I awake, escape, and run. In the morning, may I have the sake to scrape the funds. And if I take the plunge, may it be said that I wasn't afraid to shake my tongue. Show the state was gone. Making sure that the calling bell of fate was rung. Cause if they could, they wouldn't probably try to rape the sun. Someone said that this is just my body. Wait for the after party. Wait, no shut off note in air while it is. Now they feet on the asphalt, picking the dirt. This system take big in the work. Listen to learn. Check out the introvert in the corner with the rip in her skirt. Stomach pain, so she gripping her shirt. Ain't never had dinner, so she knows she ain't getting dessert. Don't try to tell me it's her mission to hurt. I got faith in the people and they power to fight. We gon' make the struggle blossom like a flower to life. I know that we could take power tonight. Make them cower for might and get emergency clearance from the tower for flight. I ain't sitting in your pews unless you helping me resist and review. Show me a list of your views if you really love me. Help me tear this mother up. Consider this my time for the offer cup.
Preacher man wanna save my soul. Don't nobody wanna save my life. People, we done lost control. Let's make heaven tonight. Preacher man wanna save my soul. Don't nobody wanna save my life. People, we done lost control. Let's make heaven tonight.
I used to think about infinity and how my memory is finna be invisibly slim in that vicinity. Though the stars are magnificent, whiskey in the midnight sky can make you feel insignificant. The revolution in this tuning verse is a bid for my love to touch the universe. Struggling over wages and funds, let the movement get contagious and run through the end when it's gauges and guns. And if we win in the ages to come, we'll have a chapter where the history pages are from. They won't never know our name or face, but feel our soul and free food they taste. Feel our passion when they heat their house, when they got power on the street and the police don't beat them about. Let's make healthcare centers on every block. Let's give everybody homes and a garden plot. Let's give all the schools books, 10 kids a class, and give them truth for their pencils and pads. Retail clerk, love ballots where you place this on. Let's make heaven right here just in case they wrong.
Preacher man wanna save my soul.